At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Midnight has passed, and in the stillness of these hours, the hauntings are never silent. This is Real Ghost Stories Online, After Midnight.
I never really know how to start this story because to me, it doesn't feel like a story at all. It feels like my life. My parents have lived in their home for nearly 40 years now. 4 decades under the same roof, walking the same hallways, fighting in the same rooms, laughing around the same tables. A place that long lived doesn't stay neutral. It soaks everything in. And I think that house soaked in more than just memories. I was the youngest of 4 kids, the so-called baby of the family. My brother and 2 sisters were already 8 to 10 years older by the time I came along, so it sometimes felt like I was growing up with more parents than siblings. Our house wasn't exactly peaceful. There was yelling, fighting, nights where doors slammed and voices carried through the walls. It wasn't the worst childhood, but it was far from the perfect family you see in sitcom reruns. That tension, that heaviness, was always in the background, and I can't help but wonder if the house picked up on it, feeding off that energy. Some of my earliest memories are the kind you laugh at later, but in the moment, they left an impression. I was about 8 years old, lying in the den with my sisters. We were watching TV when I complained about being hot. My older sister agreed, and within seconds, the old 70s-style ceiling fan above us roared to life on its own. The switch hadn't been touched. We all stared at it, mouths half open, trying to figure out what just happened. In the end, we chalked it up to the dial being loose, some little quirk of old wiring. But I can still feel that mix of awe and unease in my stomach, like the room had just winked at us. Our family loved horror movies, loved them a little too much, honestly. From the time I was far too young, my siblings would force me to watch whatever VHS tape they dug out of the cabinet. Most were cheesy enough that I could shrug them off, but the demonic ones, The Exorcist, those messed me up. I was terrified of possession, of things you couldn't fight. For years, that movie haunted me, all the way into adulthood. Now I can watch it like it's nothing, but back then, it planted a seed of dread that never really left me. It didn't help that we had a Ouija board in the house. My mom had been given it as a gift when she was 12, and for my siblings, it was more toy than tool. They'd drag it out to scare each other and, more often than not, to torment me. They'd make the planchette move on silly questions, laughing when I got upset. One time, a friend of my sister asked me when I was going to die. The pointer slid across the board to spell something, and everyone laughed while I sat there horrified. It was all a joke to them, but for me, the idea that the house itself might be listening and might be answering stuck. By the time I hit my teens, the oddities around the house started to feel less like quirks and more like a pattern. One night, I was in the den with my oldest sister. The TV was on, a single lamp glowing beside us when a massive shadow passed across the glass of the back door. It looked human, big, broad, like our dad walking by. We both turned immediately, expecting to see him step into the room. No one was there. The backyard was empty. My dad was still in bed with my mom, swearing he hadn't gotten up. My sister and I just stared at each other, both of us silently acknowledging that what we saw had no explanation. We laughed it off, but it was a thin laugh, more defense than amusement. The den, the hallways, the quiet corners of the house, they all seemed to hold a certain charge. My bedroom was at the end of the hall, and the living room sat at the other end. Whenever I had to walk to my room at night, especially if all the lights were off, I felt eyes on me from the living room. It was always worse in the dark. During the day when the sun streamed in, It was just a room. At night, with the house hushed and my footsteps echoing down the hall, it felt like something stood in that living room waiting, watching. I was so unnerved by it that I carried a doll with me on bathroom trips until I was 10, as if a toy could somehow protect me. The sounds came next. Footsteps where there shouldn't be footsteps. The clink of something being set down in the kitchen when no one was there. Our old screen door made a horrific squeal whenever it opened or closed, and more than once I heard that sound even while I stood right in front of the door, staring at it, unmoving, with no one on the other side. Strangely enough, those sounds didn't scare me as much as the feelings did. I used to tell myself those noises were echoes, old memories playing themselves back. It was easier to believe that than to admit something unseen was moving around us. Looking back now, those childhood experiences seem almost minor compared to what came later. But at the time, they were enough to plant the idea that the house was alive in some way. Not alive like a person, but alive like a sponge, soaking up all our tension, our laughter, our grief, and then spitting it back out in ways we didn't always understand. And as I got older, the things that happened in that house and in the houses of my sisters would only grow darker. By the time I was a teenager, the strangeness around me had settled into a rhythm, not constant, but often enough to remind me that it wasn't going away. Most of the time, it was small things. The prickling sense of being watched, shadows moving where they shouldn't, the heaviness in the hallway late at night. It wasn't dramatic enough to make anyone believe me if I said it out loud, but it was there, always humming in the background. Then my sister, the third child, moved into a house just down the street. I spent a lot of time there, and almost immediately, that house gave me the same kind of uneasy feeling our childhood home did. The first day I walked in, I noticed this massive, gaudy mirror in the kitchen. It stretched full length, positioned in such a way that when you stood at the counter, you could see straight down the hall behind you. The sight line felt unnatural, like the house wanted you to look over your shoulder. That mirror unsettled me from the start, and I wasn't surprised when the unease grew stronger the longer I spent there. If you stood in that kitchen washing dishes or cooking, it was common to feel someone right behind you, leaning in just close enough that the hair on your neck stood up. It didn't feel threatening, not at first, more like a nosy presence that wanted to watch. Still, it was unnerving. When I was 18, I got pregnant, and I often babysat my sister's kids at that house. Nights alone, there were the hardest. I'd hear my name whispered from nowhere, sometimes as soft as a sigh. Sometimes clear and loud, like someone was calling for me across the room. Once in a while, I'd even hear the phone ring when I was already on it, an impossible overlapping sound that left me staring at the receiver in my hand. The strangest part was the footsteps. I'd be sitting at the computer in the front room and hear little feet running down the hallway, the same hall that mirror faced. It was so convincing that I always thought it was my niece slipping out of bed. I'd rush down the hall expecting to find her awake, only to see her still asleep in her crib, the room lit with the overhead light. I'd switch the light off, go back to my chair, and minutes later hear the feet again, patter, 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 followed by the light clicking on once more. Over and over. At first, I checked every time. Eventually, I gave up. You can only chase shadows for so long before exhaustion takes over. One night stands out above the rest. My sister was out with friends, her husband was working a graveyard shift, and I was babysitting. I was in the den when I heard the distinct sound of shoes in the kitchen. That sharp clack my sister's favorite pair always made. A second later, I heard her voice call my name loud and clear, like she had just come home and was looking for me. Relieved she was back, I called, "What?" and waited for her to walk in. No answer. I walked into the kitchen, empty. The front door was still locked. I checked her room, thinking maybe she'd slipped in quietly and collapsed into bed. But it was empty, too. Hours later, when she finally did come home, I asked her what she'd wanted earlier. She looked at me confused. She swore she hadn't been home at all. That one left both of us shaken. We laughed nervously, but the truth clung to the back of my mind. Something else had walked into that kitchen that night, something that wanted me to think it was her. Not long after I had my daughter, for the first couple of years, everything felt normal. But when she turned two, things began to shift again. One day I noticed a pattern. If a toy rolled near my bedroom closet, she'd creep toward it slowly, then suddenly turn and bolt back to me, sobbing in terror. At that age, she couldn't explain what she saw or felt. All I knew was that something in or around that closet terrified her. I asked my sisters to watch her behavior to see if maybe I was overreacting. They saw it too. The way she froze at the threshold, the way her face crumpled before she fled crying. It rattled all of us. It's one thing to feel scared yourself. It's another to see a child, your child, react that way to something you can't see or fight. I felt powerless. Of course, my sisters thought they had a solution. Their bright idea was to break out the Ouija board. Yes, the same one my mom had gotten at 12 and use it in my room, near the closet. I begged them not to. I didn't want that thing anywhere near my daughter's fear, but they went ahead anyway. They sat down, closed their eyes, and started asking questions. I stood in the doorway, furious and scared. Within a minute, both of them stopped breathing. Their faces went pale, eyes shut tight, tears slipping down their cheeks as they sat frozen. For what felt like an eternity, probably only a minute, they didn't move. Then, all at once, they gasped like drowning people breaking the surface. I'd had enough. I told them to get the hell out of my room and take that board with them. Whatever curiosity they had wasn't worth the risk. But once a door's opened, even slightly, it doesn't always close again. Things escalated. A friend of mine, a skeptic through and through, came over one night. She swore she saw a tall, dark figure standing in the doorway wearing a top hat. I told her to stop messing with me, but she insisted. Days later, my sisters brought up, out of the blue, a memory from when we were kids of seeing a shadow man in broad daylight walk across the backyard. Their description matched my friend's perfectly. Tall, dark, wearing a top hat. They didn't even know she'd seen something. I felt my stomach drop. This wasn't just me. It wasn't just my imagination. Other people were seeing it too. By then, it was clear the strangeness wasn't confined to one house or one person. It followed us. It lingered in closets, in hallways, in mirrors. It appeared to friends who didn't believe and frightened children who couldn't explain. It didn't matter how much we laughed it off or tried to rationalize. The presence had embedded itself in our lives. And what came next, the night with my sister in the den, the night I truly thought something had taken her over, would be the moment that terrified me most of all. The night I ran from my sister, the one who walked into the den and spoke like someone else, that image marked a line I hadn't known existed. I was 20 then, raw and reckless, and the way she sat there like a doll with her back straight, hands folded, eyes fixed, it cut something loose in me. I screamed. I ran. I woke the oldest and dragged them both back to the den until the morning light felt like refuge. My sister swore she had been watching MTV the whole time and had no memory of standing motionless. I left the house shaking and more certain than ever that whatever visited us didn't need permission. It borrowed faces like someone trying on clothes. You learn living with this that the small things matter. Little details that other people dismiss as coincidences are often the whole story. The vacuum that tipped over by itself in my oldest sister's townhouse. The phone call that dropped out after a scream and then went dead. My daughter screaming until I pulled her out of the car because the back seat felt like ice. Those things stack. Alone, anything might be explained. Stacked together, they make a pattern that looks like an argument. Someone, something, was trying to be heard. After the weed night, after I'd run to the oldest sister sobbing, something shifted in the way we treated the house and in how we talked. We tried to document. We tried to debunk. We bought a cheap camcorder and left it in the den for a week. It picked up nothing but a cat padding past at 2 a.m. We ran audio. We tested wiring. We checked for drafts. There were mundane answers for some of it. The fan might have had a loose switch. Wiring can make lights flicker. Children forget to latch doors. But the footage that was recorded with no source while we heard footsteps still sat on the hard drive like a refusal. It had captured the sound without the body that made it. I remember the afternoon my oldest sister finally stopped smirking when we told her stories. She called us hysterical one morning, voice tight, saying things had started to fall in her house with no one there to touch them. A plate slid off a counter, a picture frame crashed to the floor. The vacuum tipped over. We drove over and found her shaking, white-faced, standing in the kitchen, while a dozen little things lay where they'd fallen as if pushed by invisible hands. That day she stopped saying, "It's nothing," and started listening. Not everyone wants to listen, though. People get defensive. They need life to be tidy. Probably rats, someone will say, or kids playing pranks. I get it. We told ourselves those things for a long time because the alternative, that the house kept memories and sometimes let them out, felt too big. It was easier to label a thing and move on. But there's a cruelty to denial. It leaves you unprepared. It buys you comfort now and costs you mystery later. One of the hardest parts is the way the phenomena folded into the rhythms of day-to-day life. My daughter's terror at the closet, for instance, forced choices. Do you move? Do you fix the house like you fix furniture? Replace this, close that, repaint? We did small things. Moved the mirror, stopped leaving toys on the floor, kept the lights on in the den at night. For a while, it helped. Children forget if the world keeps giving them new scaffolding, but memory has its own stubbornness. My daughter grew out of the closet fear, but the memory of her little body sprinting from that corner is forever lodged in my chest. There's an overlay here, a cultural one, that's hard to pin down. My family didn't come from a place that treated the supernatural as quaint. There are old world beliefs that carry through generations in ways you can't explain logically. Prayers muttered under breath, a salt line over a doorway, the tendency to call an elder when something can't be fixed. We tried a little of that, tentatively. At one point, my mother suggested we bless the house in the way her grandmother used to, a small oil, a spoken prayer, a shared meal afterward. We did it not because we were certain it would work, but because ritual sometimes steadies you. It did something. Maybe it was the communal intention. Maybe it was timing. But afterward, there was a quiet spell for a few months. Quiet is a mercy you begin to hoard. There were other nights when nothing helped. Once, standing in the kitchen at the sink, I had that prickling again, like someone breathing over my shoulder. I turned slowly, expecting a face. Nothing. Just the mirror angled odd and a slight press of the air. I told the presence out loud with more bravado than I felt, "You are not welcome here." For a second, the house watched me back, and then the pressure lifted. I don't know if telling it to go was the cause or if I was riding the moment and forcing myself to stand up to fear. Either way, speaking against the thing felt better than being silent. You pick up strategies. You sleep with the radio low, a noise that makes the house feel less lonely. You leave closet doors open. You avoid summoning in any way that feels petty. You stop playing with Ouija boards and stop telling kids that the fun lies on the other side of daring. You teach your children not to reason with fear, but to outlast it, and to tell you when the night is too loud. The practical and the ritualistic start to merge. Therapy for anxiety, check. A blessing for the threshold, check. A combination of tools works in different measures. And still, the top-hatted man keeps walking through our memories. When the friend who never believed confessed to seeing him, it reframed everything because it showed that disbelief isn't always a shield. Sometimes the world decides who gets to see it. Sometimes skeptics get a glance that rearranges their assumptions. After she told us the story that had felt private, it became an eerie, shared thing. The top hat was a detail that felt almost cinematic, anachronistic, as if the house sometimes wore clothes from another era and walked them out across our lawn. Maybe that's what the mirror showed, echoes of people who once moved through those spaces in a different century. Or maybe it was a conjured image that borrowed theatricality because it knew it would be noticed. Years later, I find myself less interested in labels than in balance. I read articles and forums, and the theories proliferate. Electromagnetism, infrasound, poltergeist activity, residual hauntings, psychokinetic manifestations. The science is useful in a way. It gives you testable variables. But experience has taught me that not everything polite yields to analysis. Some things are stubbornly ambiguous, and maybe that's part of the point. It forces you to acknowledge limits. Limits of control, of explanation, of authority. People ask if I regret telling these stories. Sometimes I do, because once a thing is named, it becomes a kind of possession of the mind. But retelling also performs a function. It releases some of the weight, it gathers witnesses, and it invites advice. I've had friends and strangers offer salt lines, sage, priestly blessings, practical fixes. I took some of the advice, politely declined other parts. I do not think there's a universal fix. Houses are particular, people are particular, grief and laughter and the small cruelties of life leave an imprint that is unique to the roof that sheltered them. The strangest, most humbling lesson is that fear is not only born of real things, sometimes people, especially young people, have a kind of imaginative power that can call up forms, a convergence of attention and suggestion that feels like conjuring. I watched my sisters and friends dare each other, watched us collectively prod the house with jokes and dares. Maybe the house responded because we looked at it long enough. Maybe we fed it with our attention. The thought makes me uneasy, but also gives agency where helplessness once ruled. If attention shapes reality, then vigilance and intentionality might reconfigure it. These days, I sleep with less fury toward the house. I tell my daughter stories, not to frighten her, but to teach her to name the things that scare her, to teach her that saying, "This is not welcome," has force, to teach her how to ask for help. We moved a few times, but memories follow like weather. Wherever you go, some climates cling. I still glance at full-length mirrors with a polite suspicion and keep the closet, where she once froze, closed more often than not. Sometimes when a late wind leans on the windows, I swear I hear a soft shuffle in the hall. And for a second, the old audience of the house settles in, listening. I greet them quietly and go on with my life. If there is any advice I'd give someone who moves into a house that hums the same way ours did, it's this. Be careful what you invite. Don't make a ritual out of joking with the things you don't want. Be tender with small people and with old objects. If you have a child who starts to run from a closet, don't ridicule them. Pay attention. If your friends want to play with something that has a history, be the one to say no. And when you feel the press at the back of your neck, don't just laugh it off, name it. Say out loud that you are present and that this house has limits. I don't claim to have solved anything. I only have a life that holds a trail of oddities and a family that learned to move within them. We are less dramatic now. We are quieter about the things we can't explain. But sometimes, late at night, when my daughter sleeps and the house exhales itself into silence, I stand in the doorway and let the rooms remember me for a moment. I don't ask for explanations. I only ask to be left in peace. And often, not always, but often, the house listens.
Want more real ghost stories? Then press subscribe now so you don't miss any of the multiple new ghost stories we drop for you every day. Only here at Real Ghost Stories Online.
Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to
get your bag.
Two ways to peel for a chance to
get your bag.
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to
get your bag.
Play Monopoly at McDonald's.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
No purchase necessary. See rules at playatmcd.com for full details and amoe.playatmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus play ends November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.